The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Lots to get to on today's program. We have Richard Palmer in the studio to discuss with us in just a few minutes the political earthquake happening right now in Britain. We'll come to Richard here in just a second. Also, I thought I'd mention that coming up on KPCG later today, in fact, right after this program at the top of the hour, you have Joel Hilliker's Wednesday show, The Trumpet Hour, where he'll be talking about the new booklet that we're just now producing, January 16th, God's Miracle Day. And I think on this particular program, Mr. Hilliker is going to be taking you through some of the content from that booklet and some of the many miraculous things that have happened over the years on or around January the 16th. Of course, January the 16th is the anniversary of Herbert Armstrong's death. We're 33 years on from that death back in 1986, and of course we're 29 years on from the time when many people received Malachi's message for the first time. That was in January of 1990. So coming up on today's show in the second segment, we'll be taking you back to that work of Herbert Armstrong and giving you some clips. If many of you old-timers probably remember the 1986 World Tomorrow tribute program. We've assembled five or six clips from that program that you'll want to listen to coming up later on in the show. Well, when the United Kingdom joined the European Community in 1973, many people were celebrating. They were talking about sunny days ahead for the UK. Herbert Armstrong, as so many of you know, he was at that same time delivering a very sobering warning. He said this: Britain is going to look back on January 1st, 1973, in all probability, as a most tragically historic date, a date fraught with ominous potentialities, for that date marked the United Kingdom's entry into the European Community. Well, today, Mr. Armstrong's ominous potentialities, they're now the reality. That's what we're seeing here in the UK. Britain's membership in the EU, taking it all the way up to the vote to leave in 2016, to the spectacle that we saw just yesterday, and maybe tonight. Look at the harm and the divisiveness. Look at the chaos. It's caused all kinds of political chaos and division, financial and economic uncertainty, and there's a growing amount of social discord as well. Yesterday, as some of you may have seen, Theresa May's Brexit deal, it didn't just fail in the House of Commons or in Parliament. It failed in a spectacular fashion. One paper said that this wasn't a political loss. It was more like a nuclear event. The British political system is broken. These are just some of the highlights from British commentators today. British politics goes over a cliff. This has left the country adrift, one said, floating towards no deal, with no party or faction in Parliament able to command a majority for any way of moving off the course it has set for itself. Another newspaper said this marks a low point, a new low point of chaos for the process of the UK leaving the European Union. Herbert W. Armstrong was right. Just like we have on our cover. He was right. He said it back in 1973. Many were saying sunny days ahead in 1973. Many were saying sunny days ahead in 2016. And yet look at what we're seeing. Sam and Richard put in some work on a short montage that just summarizes the events of yesterday and last night here in the UK.
This is the most significant vote that any of us will ever be part of in our political careers. After all the debate, all the disagreement, all the division, the time has now come for all of us in this House to make a decision.
After 2.5 years of procrastination, the public would accuse us in this place of deliberately setting out to frustrate their wishes, and they would conclude that there was some plot by the deep state to kill Brexit.
Because Brexit should mean Brexit, and no deal is better than this bad deal, I shall vote no, no, and no.
What are you playing at?
Yeah. Yeah.
What are you doing? You are not children in the playground.
We witnessed similar events in May 1940, when the then Prime Minister actually won the vote on the Norway debate, but on reflection concluded that he had to resign because he had lost the confidence of Parliament as a whole. I believe, therefore, there are lessons in this for the Prime Minister to consider her position and to do so with dignity and without rancour.
The ayes to the right, 202. The noes to the left, 432.
This deal is finished, it's over, it's dead.
The results of tonight's vote is the greatest defeat for a government since the 1920s in this House. This is a catastrophic defeat for this government. The most important issue facing us is that the government has lost the confidence of this House and this country. I therefore, Mr. Speaker, inform you I have now tabled a motion of no confidence in this government. And I'm pleased that motion will be debated tomorrow, so this House can give its verdict on the sheer incompetence of this government and pass that motion of no confidence in the government.
All that just yesterday and last night, the last MP you heard there, Jeremy Corbyn, the one calling for the no confidence vote. And we have with us now in the studio our very own Richard Palmer. And Richard, as you were watching this all play out yesterday, what were you doing? What were you thinking? I know you had your eyes on the news all the way up through to last night. You wrote the Trumpet Brief. Let's see, I've got the title page on the back here. Why Britain Faces a Historic Crisis. Drew attention to the ominous potentialities quote from 1973. But maybe you can begin by just summarizing the significance of these events from yesterday. I know your Trumpet Brief brings out that there's still a lot of uncertainty, but what were your initial thoughts following the events of yesterday?
Yeah, definitely just a lot on the chaos, uncertainty, confusion. I mean, I think I don't recall... I mean, obviously, I've not been sitting watching British politics for a huge amount of time, but I don't recall any time where things have been so unclear, so chaotic. Just this sense from everyone that, well, we have no idea what's happening, where to go. Even the Prime Minister yesterday, after the vote, she said, well, Parliament's spoken, but I still have no idea. You know, we know what Parliament doesn't want. I still have no idea what Parliament does want. The Spectator quoted some of her aides saying that even senior ministers don't know what the Prime Minister wants. It's kind of this situation where it feels like nobody in the country has any idea what's going to happen. It's even, I mean, it's not even a case of, okay, there are these two fairly simple options. It's either this or this. We don't know which one. It's even more uncertain than that. And so you've got that on one side. And then on the other side, just... the division that's there deeply within the whole country.
Right.
And you see it in Parliament, where Parliament cannot unify against any positive step of action. You can get a majority to disagree with something, but there's nobody that will actually, there's no majority to really agree on anything. And then you saw it just outside Parliament as well, where right when this was going on, you had pro-EU protesters and anti-EU protesters were outside trying to make as much noise as possible. For the last few weeks, it's been pretty humorous, but you know, anytime you're watching those TV interviews and they're out in front of Parliament trying to interview some MP, there's always a protester trying to get in the shot in the background. And again, there was a Spectator piece over the weekend making the point that you never saw this before. Even just the division within politicians where the names they'll call each other, the rancor with which they address each other, you never really saw that before. So you've got this unprecedented chaos, unprecedented uncertainty, unprecedented division and animosity just all across British politics.
Yeah, I kind of stole the thought there at the top of the show, but I love the point that you made in your trumpet brief last night, where you said that following the 2016 Brexit vote, that many were proclaiming a sunny future for Britain. They're finally freed from the shackles of Europe, and Britain could go on and have its sovereignty again. And as I was thinking about it this morning, going back to 1973, and just the amount of people then, the commentators, the politicians who were saying, this is great, we can hitch our future to the European Union. And then they saw, a lot of them anyway, that that's not working out so well. Then 2016 comes, and it's almost like, if going back to what you said about both sides pitted against each other, but neither side knowing really where we're going from here, they just don't like it. It's almost like God is helping Britain to see it's not been sunny from day one, and the only one that was spot on with the forecast was Mr. Armstrong. He hit the nail right on the head, and even with all of the optimism in 2016, now you come to yesterday and today, and both sides don't know where they're going, and they don't know how to get out of this.
Yeah, one of the scriptures that I kind of built the trumpet brief on yesterday that Mr. McDonald really pointed me towards was from Isaiah 59, where it's just such a perfect description of exactly everything you just said, where it says, we look for light but find only darkness. We look for bright skies but walk in gloom. We grope like the blind along a wall, feeling our way like people without eyes. Even at brightest noontime, we stumble as though it were dark. Among the living, we are like the dead. We growl like hungry bears. We moan like mournful doves. We look for justice, but it never comes. We look for rescue, but it's far away from us. And they tried all these options for bright skies, and none of it worked out.
Right, and you referred to the other verses about the moth-eaten garment and, of course, Britain's sickness. And then you just run through some of the comments in the papers today. This is only the end of the beginning in a Brexit civil war that will last a generation. That's from a writer at The Guardian. At The Telegraph, it says, Mrs. May, more inadequate than any, clings to office with an almost messianic belief in her right to occupy it. Well, that's more of a criticism against the prime minister. Then there's the nuclear event that I mentioned at the top of the show. But yeah, maybe too, you could just comment on, you were mentioning this in our meeting this morning about lesser defeats. This is a catastrophic defeat, but how that much lesser defeats have led to the resignations of prime ministers in years past, but not with this one.
No, she's very determined to stick around. And we heard it from Bill Cash in the montage there, the MP, saying, well, look, Neville Chamberlain, he won the vote on Norway. He won by 80 votes, but he felt like that wasn't enough, that was so slim of a margin, that so many Conservative MPs rebelled against him, that he needed to step down. And you saw that even with Theresa May, where she won her vote of no confidence from the Conservative Party just a few months ago, or a month or so ago. And again, in the past, Conservative leaders would have said, okay, well, I won, but it wasn't anywhere close to unanimous. A lot of my own party voted against me. Therefore, I don't have the confidence of my own party. I don't have the vote. I don't have the support of enough of my party. I'll step down. I'll make way for someone else to take over. And she has just, she's not done that. She's pushed on way beyond just about any other leader, I think, would have pushed on.
Now, as far as tonight is concerned, is the no confidence vote, that's at 7 p.m. or thereabouts?
Yes, I believe so.
So it was Jeremy Corbyn that put that forward, but with a majority of Tories in the House, you'll have to kind of explain to me some of the nuance of British politics here, but he would have some papers were saying he might have some chance. Well, first, I guess most are saying she'll probably pass the vote and come through barely. But what are some of the different ways that this can go?
Right. So in the last election, the Conservatives came a bit short of a majority. And so she had to come up with an arrangement with the Democratic Unionist Party from Northern Ireland.
Right.
Which in a lot of ways isn't particularly hard. The DUP generally believe about the same things as the Conservatives. They're not. There's not a huge amount of difference there. They're just a bit more focused on Northern Ireland. But the DUP don't like the Brexit deal. They voted against it yesterday. And so that was the first big unknown, was when Jeremy Corbyn called this vote, which way would the DUP swing? Because if they supported the vote of no confidence, then it seemed like he could win. They very quickly came out and said, no, we're not going to support this motion of no confidence. We still, you know, we disagree with what the Prime Minister is doing, but we don't want a regime change right now, so we'll support her. Even with the DUP, though, her support is pretty narrow. So it is possible if a few of her MPs, even just a handful, turn against her or even abstain, that she could lose. But it is looking most likely if she gets the support of her party and the DUP, well, that's it. She's in. Oh, she keeps the job. Now, if the motion does pass, though, then under the new rules that came about fairly recently, the clock starts ticking. They've got 14 days to come up with a parliament that can, or a government that can get the support of parliament. Now, that could be Jeremy Corbyn. Again, it seems a bit unlikely because he'd have to either get the support of the DUP or some Conservatives to form a government. It could be that Theresa May would step down. You would have a new Conservative leader, and then they could potentially gain support of Parliament, and you've got a new Conservative government. There's even the potential for some kind of national government where you could get, say, the more central Labour MP supporting a more left-wing Conservative leader, potentially trying to cobble something out together. I think that's probably the more of the outside chance. And then even if Theresa May does win, but by a narrow majority, it's possible that she could step down. But based on her past performance on those other occasions, it seems unlikely that she'll do so. So most likely event is it seems like she'll keep going. Next to that, it seems like there probably wouldn't be any kind of majority for something in Parliament, and so we'd be heading into general elections. With all of the uncertainty that brings, with the clock still ticking for the Brexit deal on March 29th, there's a lot of people saying that we need to go back to Europe now, and we need to get them to extend that deadline so that we stay in the EU for at least a few more months so we can sort this out.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, is that all of this is happening even as they're coming up to, it's like, I think, 70-some days now where they have to get some deal to leave with something. And so when you talk about the chaos and the ominous potentialities and all that we're seeing that's happening now politically, assuming she makes it through and she still holds a slim majority, I guess you mentioned there the possibility of a delay, but what options does she have to try to, she would, I guess, have to scrap the old deal and then try to draw up something new that would win enough of a majority to hopefully have some kind of Brexit package before the deadline?
Yeah, I think she's already reached out to Germany, because I mean, you really see in all of these negotiations who's the real head of the EU, and to try and say, well, you know, if we lose, is there any wiggle room here? And she is going back to Brussels. And typically that's the way things function in the EU. It's the way it happened with Italy, where they had an impasse over the last few months, where the EU will give ground, and often that may well be in just kind of face-saving ways, but I mean, or, you know, nothing of real substance, but gives the appearance of giving ground.
Right.
So she may push for that and hope that that's enough to come and come back to Britain. And that was probably what her plan was initially before the defeat yesterday. But then I think the scale of the defeat makes her job makes that a whole lot harder, because it's not five or six MPs she's got to convince to change their minds. It's 100.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, how do you get 100 people who didn't like this deal to like it?
Yeah.
So I think this is where you start to just get that uncertainty again. Nobody's sure what's happening. I think she's just hoping that with the deadline getting closer, with people starting to sweat, with perhaps uncertainty affecting the financial markets and the pound tanking, and if these kind of things happen, then maybe people will change their mind and they'll agree to what is basically this deal with a veneer of face-saving changes. That would be the default option, but the scale of the defeat just made that very hard.
Yeah. You touched on it a bit ago, but what generally has been Europe's reaction to all the chaos here?
Yeah, they've throughout this whole thing, they've kept a pretty united negotiating position, and I think they're playing the chaos very well. There's a lot of leaders just standing on the side saying, "Well, what do you want? Tell us what you want, and we can see about giving it to you." And I think that they're using Britain's division against it. You know,
yeah.
They know that Britain can't come up with a coherent idea of what they want, and then they're also, you see just article after article coming, not just from journalists, but EU politicians basically saying, well, look, Britain's shot itself in the foot. They've shot themselves in the head. Look how foolish Britain was to vote for Brexit, to try and discourage other nations from thinking about taking that route.
Right. Well, thanks for that, Richard. And of course, if you want to hear more, I'm sure Richard will have more to say on the developments here in the UK with Brexit on Friday's edition of Trumpet Hour.
Actually, we'll have Joshua, I think, will be our German correspondent covering Friday.
Oh, nice. Okay, so we'll have it covered from every angle. Mm-hmm. Fantastic. Well, as I said at the top of the show, speaking of Trumpet Hour, we also have today's special that comes up at the top of the hour, right after this program is over, Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker, where he'll be talking about January 16th, God's Miracle Day, our newest booklet produced just today, just for this special anniversary day. And when we come back after the break, we'll be taking you back to the very beginning of the Philadelphia era of God's church. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. To those who followed the broadcasts and writings of Herbert W. Armstrong throughout his long ministry, and who still remember, world events today are an electrifying endorsement of the power of biblical revelation. Much of Mr. Armstrong's forecasting was proven accurate within his own lifetime, but since his death in 1986, events are proving him right all the more. For a comprehensive review of Mr. Armstrong's analysis, request our free booklet, He Was Right. He Was Right summarizes many of the Bible-based prophecies Mr. Armstrong proclaimed for more than 50 years. This booklet takes you back to the spiritual roots of the Philadelphia Church of God and the Trumpet magazine. To assemble the material in this booklet, our staff looked back through decades of old plain truth issues, looking for Mr. Armstrong's bold predictions. We then matched those prophetic statements with what actually happened or is now happening on the world scene. The result was amazing. The sheer number of prophetic statements made by Mr. Armstrong and his editorial team and their accuracy will astound you. The world may scoff, but Herbert Armstrong was right. Just how right is daily becoming apparent as we teeter on the brink of catastrophic global events that will lead to the greatest geopolitical intervention of all time, the return of Jesus Christ to this war-torn, war-weary earth. To order our free booklet, email your request to td@kpcg.fm. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
Herbert W. Armstrong was one of the pioneers of religious broadcasting. His voice was first heard on the air in 1933 when he was offered 15 minutes of airtime on station KORE, then broadcasting with only 100 watts to the towns and villages of the Willamette Valley in Oregon. In later years, Mr. Armstrong would often reminisce about his early experiences in broadcasting.
Then, in October 1933, I had an opportunity to go on the local radio station five mornings for 15 minutes. It was free time, and they couldn't get ministers in local churches to take the time, and so I was able to get it, and of course I didn't have to pay for it. Now, that led to the radio church. There was quite a lot of mail coming in, and the manager of the station asked me then to start a regular Sunday program. And so the church went on the air, and I did the speaking. And on the first Sunday in 1934, we went on Sunday morning at 10 o'clock, and the cost was $2.50 a week, and I only had the money pledged from the brethren for $1.25 a week. And I had to take the rest of it on faith. That was the beginning of the what we call then the Radio Church of God. February 1st, the Plain Truth came out with its first issue, mimeographed. Only about 350 copies were made.
That's a little bit from the tribute program that the World Tomorrow put together back in 1986, following the death of Herbert Armstrong on this day, January 16th, 1986. He took you back, or that program did. It took you back to the beginning, the very beginning stages of this work, God's work through Herbert Armstrong, the mustard seed beginning, the day of small beginnings, starting initially on radio in 1933 with that free slot that was offered to him, just 15 minutes a week. And then the mail started to come in, and he was offered a 30-minute slot. He'd have to pay for it every single week. And he stepped out in faith. He got enough for half of the cost. And then God provided the rest every week. And the work started in the smallest of ways, a 100-watt radio station in Northwest Oregon. And we've gone through some of the other significant anniversaries. As I said a week and a half ago, there's so many of them in the month of January, not just this one, January 16th, but January the 7th, when it was off and running, the radio show. And then we even began our TV show back in 1993, right around that same date. That, as I say, the beginning of a worldwide work. This next clip from that same tribute show talks about the small beginning and where it went from there. This is clip two.
It was a small and humble beginning, but like the proverbial grain of mustard seed, the work was destined to grow. By 1944, the World Tomorrow radio program could be heard throughout the United States. In 1953, it went on the most powerful station on Earth at that time, Radio Luxembourg, broadcasting to the British Isles and the continent of Europe.
The World Tomorrow.
The World Tomorrow first became a television program in 1955, when television was a relatively new medium.
Broadcaster and editor Herbert W. Armstrong reveals the startling significance behind today's world troubles with the prophecies of the World Tomorrow, when wild animals shall be tame, a lion and a lamb playing together, and a little child leading them in a world of peace at last. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Armstrong.
Well, greetings, friends. The real significance behind today's world disturbances is simply this, that we're now near world peace, believe it or not.
There's that distinctive voice from 1955, from one of those first TV programs. They didn't stay on television for that long because they discovered that radio was still having a powerful impact. But TV would certainly come into play more prominently later on, particularly in the last 7 years of his life. And I'll come to that in just a moment. But a few other things of worthy significance here to remind you of from that same tribute program, Clip 3.
As the World Tomorrow program began to be heard worldwide, the Plain Truth circulation also began to grow, first in thousands and then in millions. The Plain Truth is unique among the world's mass circulation magazines, carefully analyzing the real meaning behind the news of the day, foretelling trends in world events with an accuracy that is based on the prophecies of the Bible. New languages were added over the years: German, French, Spanish, Dutch, Italian, and Norwegian. Today, The Plain Truth has a circulation of 8 million, with readers in nearly every country on Earth.
Now, that was the peak for the Plain Truth, the mid-1980s. 8 million, more than, as we've said before, more than Time and Newsweek combined. This was back when news magazines were quite popular, not so much today, not in print anyway, but back in the 80s, The Plain Truth went right around the world in all these different languages into practically every country on this earth. The program, The World Tomorrow Show, it was something like 430 or 440 stations. And you had Mr. Armstrong in his late 80s and early 90s. He was the featured presenter. And of course, during all of this time, the late 60s, all through the 70s, all through the 1980s, up till his death, he was also traveling the world, meeting with world leaders, presidents, prime ministers, kings, monarchs, all over the world. We forget that this went on almost two decades. It started in 1967, as the narrator brings out in this next clip, clip 4.
In 1967, a remarkable door was opened for Mr. Armstrong to begin to reach some of the most important and influential men and women in the world. For almost 20 years, Mr. Armstrong traveled thousands of miles, meeting with kings, emperors, presidents, prime ministers, and leaders of many nations. The walls of his study are lined with mementos of those visits, gifts from the leaders of nations great and small.
I probably have visited more heads of government in their own offices than any other man. What do I talk about? I talk about the conditions that they're confronted with. I talk about world conditions and problems, problems that are far greater than they themselves are able to cope with. I talk about the cause of these conditions. I go as an ambassador, an unofficial ambassador for world peace. And they receive me as an ambassador for world peace. But I have to tell them why we don't have peace. I have to show them how peace is going to come and why we don't have it. And you know, that makes sense to heads of state. They're practical men. They see these things about them all the time. And they begin to listen when I talk about those things. Do I talk about the kingdom of God? Yes, I do. And God is going to intervene. And sometimes I tell them that straight out. They've called me an unofficial ambassador for world peace. And so I am. But let me say that there has to be a reason why we don't have peace. And you cannot have peace until there is something that will cause that peace. And there has to be a reason why something has caused us to have just the opposite of peace in this world today. And I'm afraid so many don't understand that. Now, in the world today, there are many different ideologies and philosophies and religions, and everybody seems to think that their own, of course, is the right one and the only one that is true and correct. And I did not come to bring any religion or philosophy or ideology, but just to state a few facts that are facts. We do not have peace and will not have peace until human nature has been changed.
That last bit there was from one of his public appearance campaigns, I believe in Nepal. But you get a good little synopsis there of the remarkable doors that God opened for his servant, his apostle. Apostle meaning one sent. God sent him right around the world to meet with kings and prime ministers, to meet with some of the most influential people on earth. And he took the true gospel message into those presidential palaces. He took God's truth to world leaders. And this was all happening in the last 15 to 20 years of his life. That's what's most remarkable about this history, is how God empowered him late in life. A couple of weeks ago, I took you through some of the history from 1979 and the state of California's attack on the Worldwide Church of God. Just 15 months before that attack, Mr. Armstrong's heart failed him. He suffered from heart failure. His breathing completely stopped. He was 85 years old at that time, the time of his heart failure. God brought him back to life. And for a reason, Mr. Armstrong wrote later, he said, "It is now clearly evident that God brought me back for a vital purpose. Had I remained dead, the Church of the Living God would have been virtually destroyed by the liberal element that had crept in, especially in headquarters, during my absence from Pasadena." He said that had God not brought him back to life, the church would have been destroyed. So he came back, and even though they accused him of senility and siphoning off millions of dollars when they brought that unconstitutional lawsuit against the church, the receivership, he fought back, as I covered in those recent programs. I wrote about it in the Trumpet Brief on Monday, some of that history. Fascinating history, inspiring history. Any other individual would have probably caved in to the pressure, or maybe moved off into retirement. Following heart failure in his mid-80s, well, he came back. He not only came back, he came back strong, and he squashed the liberal element. And really, he led the Worldwide Church of God into its golden age. Those last 7-8 years. It was pitiful, some of the stats in the late 70s. While he was traveling the world, meeting with those world leaders, the plain truth circulation was dwindling. The income was evaporating away. I think they were only on 50 television stations at the end of the 1970s, and his son Garner Ted was taking care of those responsibilities. But then Mr. Armstrong had to come back and put the church back on the track. That was in 1978 when he started cleaning house. And then in 1979 he had to fight against this audacious, outrageous attack. Through this time, he's writing Incredible Human Potential. Just that alone. If you've read that book, you see just how engaged he was spiritually and how much he was getting done, even at the age of 85. Then he took on the television responsibilities. And what happened in the early 1980s? Another remarkable miracle. You can read about the small beginnings in Zechariah 4. God also says there that he would move mountains for that end time Zerubbabel. Well, once he squashed that liberal element and fought back against the state of California, the church then, the worldwide church of God, really took off. And the circulations increased. They bought more television time. They reopened the college. They basically had to start that over because the liberal element had destroyed so much of God's work and God's truth. And like Mr. Armstrong said, had he died in 1977, they would have destroyed the church back then. Well, it certainly gave us a preview what happened there in the 70s. It gave us a preview of what would happen after he died in 1986. But from 1979 to 1986, that was the golden age of God's work in the sixth era, the Philadelphia era of God's church. And during that time, I bring this out in Raising the Ruins, another amazing development. Miraculous, I think. It had such an impact on so many people. And really, it was the fulfillment of Malachi 4, verses 5 and 6. He put the focus on family and the youths, the children. Here he is in his late 80s. He's reestablishing the college. He's establishing all of these Youth Opportunity United programs, the summer youth camps. He started the Youth Educational Service for the preteens. All of these youth programs, as God was turning the hearts of the fathers to their children and the hearts of the children to their fathers. That's what the Elijah work did in those final years. And what a blessing it was for people like me and for my family. All of those programs that took us all over the, at that time, the great Northwest in Washington, well, Oregon, Idaho, all over the place, Montana. We went down to Salt Lake on occasion. An explosive growth for the church throughout. It went from an income of something like 40 to 50 million in the late 70s to 100 to 160 to 170 million by the mid to late 80s. And then, as if that wasn't enough, he comes into the last year of his life. Of course, he doesn't know it's his last year, but he's 92 years of age. 92 years of age, and he begins work on what would be his greatest work in life. That would be Mystery of the Ages. He said in 1985, with the writing of the new book, Mystery of the Ages, God has helped me this year to do the best work of my 93 years of life. He did his best work in his last year. He said at that same time that God had helped him to understand more in the last 10 years of his life than he had in all the previous decades. It's incredible. Some of you may remember the comments that he made to the sophomore class at Ambassador College when he could finally hand out Mystery of the Ages to them. He was sick at this time. In the summer, I think this was August of 1985, he was beginning another round-the-world trip. He was going to stop in the at the youth camp in Orr, Minnesota, and then carry on, I think, to Japan or somewhere around the world. But at the start of the trip, he started getting sick, and they had to return home. And then he was basically confined to his house for those last 4 or 5 months. He had just finished Mystery of the Ages. And the only time he came out from being confined to his house, he gave a message, I believe, on the Feast of Trumpets. And then there was the date. I didn't write it down. I think it was in early September, where he presented the sophomore class at Ambassador College with copies of Mystery of the Ages. And this is taken from that same tribute program from 1986. Here's clip five.
Mystery of the Ages was originally written for the students at Ambassador College. In August 1985, Mr. Armstrong personally presented the new book to the students of the Fundamentals of Theology class. It would prove to be one of the last times he would speak in public.
When the Bible speaks, that is God speaking, not a man. Now, it's true, Moses wrote the first five books, but it wasn't really Moses writing it. God was having him write it, and it was God writing it, but that was really inspired. And then when we come to prophets like Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, then when we come to the New Testament books, God inspired them. They are the infallible words of God. This book is not. I don't make any such claim for this book whatsoever. But I think in a way God inspired it, but not in the sense that it is the Word of God. It says God inspired Herbert Armstrong. And I tried to yield myself to him, and I hope I was able to yield myself, if not 100%, 97%, 98%, 99%. The Bible is like a book that had been sort of cut up into about 2,000 or 3,000 pieces, and you have to get them all put together in the right order, or you can't understand them. This book puts them together. And yet this book is only a synopsis. You could say it's the gist of the Bible, the synopsis. It doesn't cover all of it, but it covers the main thread of the Bible so you can understand the Bible and understand the other details when you read them in the Bible. It'll open up the Bible so that you understand it. That's what it is for. Make the Bible plain and clear and understandable. And God is such a great God when you come to really know him and who and what he is and how real he is. And I want to say that you need to read every word and you need to go over it more than once. You aren't going to get the full meat of this book in one reading. This is a book that after you've read it, you can read it a second time and then later a third time. This book is not intended to take the place of the Bible. It's intended to make it so that you will understand the Bible. You must read the Bible with it. And this is to make the Bible clear and understanding to you as you read it and bring its meaning out as you never saw it before. And I hope it'll be a blessing to you. I hope you will enjoy it. It'll give you great happiness and enjoyment. I hope you'll enjoy reading it. And I hope more than any other book you've ever read, except the Bible. And perhaps, in a sense, this makes even the Bible more clear and plain, and you'll enjoy the Bible more from now on. Will you forgive me if I get a little bit of thrill that this was then done? This book is out now. Today's a pretty big day in my life, when I can hand the copies of this book out to each of you.
Well, they really put a lot into that, the production of it, the distribution. He wanted it to reach the largest audience possible. And that work was cut short. Although God is raising the ruins. But to just close the loop on this fascinating, inspiring history. Here he was, not only sick at that time, he was virtually blind. And then going back 7, 8, 9 years before that, heart failure. He had died. And God raised him to life to remove the liberal influence in the church. Well, he didn't remove all of it, as we now know, but he got rid of a lot of it. He put the worldwide Church of God back on track. He wrote The Incredible Human Potential. He defeated the state of California in a nationally known lawsuit. He went on to become one of the most popular religious personalities on television. He quadrupled the church's growth in every major category. He raised up all of those youth programs, as I mentioned earlier. And he continued traveling the world, meeting with presidents and prime ministers. And he wrote Mystery of the Ages right at the tail end of 1984 and the first half of 1985. He handed it out to the sophomore class in September of 1985. And then on January 16th, 1986, at the age of 93, he died. This is what that tribute program said about continuing the work of Herbert Armstrong following his death. This is from The World Tomorrow back in 1986, clip 6.
This is the commission that Jesus Christ gave to his church, to preach the gospel of the kingdom to all the world before the end of the age, and the establishment of the kingdom of God, the coming time of world peace and happiness that Mr. Armstrong called the world tomorrow. That world tomorrow is not here yet, and so the work that God began through Herbert Armstrong will go on. This program will continue, and the Plain Truth magazine will continue as they have since 1934, dynamic, up-to-date, giving people around the world understanding with hope and reassurance of a better world tomorrow.
Well, knowing what we know now, that's pretty sad to hear that, to hear Art Gilmore there, he's the presenter or the narrator, talking about the program that will continue. It did not continue. The Plain Truth, there might be some version of the Plain Truth out there that goes to a few people, but that the message of the Plain Truth, that stopped. Ambassador College closed down. The work closed down. The truth was cast to the ground. The people that followed in his steps, or that said they would, they fought against us in 1997. And then for 6 years after that, they were trying to prevent us from distributing Mystery of the Ages. Well, most of you know a little something about this work and what happened in that period between January 16th, 1986 and December 7th, 1989. A great apostasy, a great falling away, and it was prophesied in 2 Thessalonians 2 and elsewhere. There was a great falling away in God's church, a rebellion led from the top. And in 1989, God revealed Malachi's message to my father, and that distribution started. As it happens, it started in January of 1990. My father was writing it all through 1989. He was fired on December 7th. And that 40-day period from December 7th to January 16th, 1990, the work of the fledgling Philadelphia Church of God, the work was preparing Malachi's message for distribution. And a few of us, there were just 13 in the church at that time, 13 people. We had the entire church over at the Thompson's house for a a mail processing party. January the 10th, 1990, that was on a Wednesday night. And we packaged 921 copies of Malachi's message. And every one of us there, we knew it was the beginning of something special. We knew it was a small beginning. We knew it was a mustard seed beginning. But we knew finally, Finally, and it started with just a few hundred people receiving Malachi's message on or around January the 16th, we knew that they could finally understand what and why all of this was happening to God's church. It was all explained in every exciting prophetic detail in Malachi's message to God's church today. From the very start of the Philadelphia Church of God, there was a very special emphasis on the January 16th anniversary. In our first year as a church, in our first year, that anniversary date was connected to Malachi's message, to the distribution of Malachi's message. And God did it that way for a reason. Because Mr. Armstrong's work, his teaching, his life, his legacy, all of that animates everything that we do to this day, the work of raising his ruins. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program and tell me a little bit about your history with God's work, you can send it to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.